What's a food you've never eaten?
Ooh, that's a really good one for me.
I've just opened a can of worms. Have you ever eaten a can of worms?
Well, no, but I have eaten ants.
Okay.
Which was
quite
nice.
What's the best way to serve ants?
The best way to serve ants... So I've had it once as like this savory pavlova.
Okay.
And I've also had it as a dessert with ice cream. So Ooh. The green ants was with the pavlova. Okay. It's like this salty, savory pavlova.
Because personally, I prefer Bug's Life.
Actually, I'm much more of a B-movie person. That's
That's the real honey on the cake. No, but seriously, what's a food that you've, like, I don't know, it's just unobtainable
to you
that you've wanted?
Yeah. I do have two. So, one of them is a dessert called semla. It's a Scandinavian dessert made during a religious season, and I can't
During their
remember.
6 months of darkness they
yeah.
have every...
No,
Wait,
no,
actually,
no, legit, no,
no
legit,
you're
it's
kidding.
Around, it's around, like, that. It's related to that.
That's
it's
amazing.
Like the solstice or something like
wow.
that. I think there it is also connected to Christian stuff,
okay.
but I'll need to look it up. So it's a Scandinavian dessert called semla. It's like this...
Smoked fish served on top of another fish.
Oof, oh, yeah. Fish on fish, man. Seafoodception. No, it's actually like this sort of brioche spiced bread
okay.
with this really nice cream, like a vanilla cream. So it's like a cream puff.
Okay.
But it's Scandinavian. And then this other thing that I haven't tried is a Taiwanese black pepper beef bun. And they make it in like these kind of like these clay ovens.
Mm.
And in Melbourne here, I haven't found either of them. Though, similar, they do sell at a Scandinavian church in Toorak.
Okay.
But I just haven't made my way there
yet. Yeah, that's quite a hipstery eating venue when you have to go to a Scandinavian church.
Oh,
to
yeah.
get a meal.
Oh,
that's
definitely.
That's pretty low key.
I will eventually. I just haven't gotten
I wonder what kind of cider
it.
They drink there.
A true
communion
cider.
It's the hipster church.
It's the hipster. It's like, guys, we don't drink red wine. We drink cider. The blood of Christ is cider, dude. How about you? What's a food that you've never eaten?
Probably a lot of things. I have not become as ambitious as you are with broadening my horizons towards food. I've never eaten dolphin.
I don't know if I'd ever want to eat dolphin.
I just want to know if it's like... Is it like a? I mean, I've eaten tuna, but I wonder if it's like a
tuna and dolphin.
Dolphin friendly,
the same
isn't it?
Thing.
But like, well, I mean, dolphins used to get caught in the tuna nets all the time. But like, would it be like a fish? Or would it be like a steak?
Ooh, because it's a mammal.
Yeah, like I want to eat some kind of like aquatic mammal that has like the same level as like a steak, but it's like infused with like the ocean salt.
That's very interesting because when you look at things like shellfish, octopus, and squid, they're all mollusks.
Yeah,
and that's why their flesh is completely different.
Yeah, exactly.
To say fish.
It's very
right?
rubbery and you know what sea creature like. I want to eat like a sea creature that's like an otter.
Yeah.
What otter would taste like.
Ooh, platypus.
Ooh, yeah, exactly.
Platypus is like, man, like, did you ever hear the story, like, when I think it was the British, when they came to Australia and they found out, like, they found the platypus. They took it back to England and they were literally just like, what the fuck?
Everyone thought it was
this?
Bad taxidermy.
Yeah.
Like, you didn't even try it. It's a beaver tail.
Yeah.
I'm like, no, we found it. It hatched out of an egg we found and it had a very poisonous spur and tried to stab us and one of us died and like...
But it's also,
not,
it's a mammal,
it's not a thing.
So...
We dug it out of a burrow that was underwater.
It's such a paradox. It's
Do you know,
a paradox.
Fun fact, Australia is the only country where you can eat both coat of arms. Like, both the animals and the coat of arms.
What are the...
It's a kangaroo and an emu.
I've eaten emu.
There you go.
Kangaroo.
You've eaten our coat of arms.
Yeah.
In
I've even
England,
had emu egg.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Ooh,
as a
I've
dessert.
Wanted to try that as a dessert.
It's really nice. So they get like a bit of the egg and they
Just
whip
fill
it.
Fill it with chocolate.
Well, very close
actually,
then.
I'm
so,
on point tonight.
You are. So the dessert I had it in was the shell of an emu egg.
Yeah.
They whipped a bit of, I think, of the emu egg into like a meringue.
Ooh.
And they put it in with chocolate ice cream.
Actually sounds amazing.
It was so delicious.
So good.
Yeah. And so the meringue was like really like rich and creamy. And then the chocolate was really like cocoa chocolatey. And it went really, really well. And they had like, do you know what finger lime is?
No.
So it's a native citrus fruit. And it just added like some acidity to cut
That's
through
dope.
The richness and chocolate.
Where was that?
Dessert. The number one restaurant in the Southern Hemisphere, actually. Yeah, it has an episode
McDonald's.
On Chef's Table. Yeah, it was so bogan. The number one restaurant.
I haven't seen more stores than McDonald's has.
But yeah, no, it's quite cool. It's called
okay.
Attica. We should go on a degustation one day. Maybe like maybe some.
I have not really broken that deep into Australian food. I've always wanted to eat crocodile.
Yeah, crocodile's pretty good. I've had it in a soup.
Mm. I'm a big fan of kangaroo. Yeah. And that's a really ethical meat. So all you vegans, you can stop harking on about kangaroo. We have so many. They're very easy to farm, use very little water, and they're tasty.
And they're very good for you.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. But yeah, I've eaten heaps of stuff. I'm actually thinking one meat that I want to try is goose.
Well, you were telling me you want to cook a goose.
Yeah, and also, have you seen that trailer for that goose game that's coming out? It's like Untitled Goose Game. It's coming out on the Switch.
What?
Yeah, haven't you heard
it? Untitled Goose Game.
Yeah, you've... Oh my god, do I know about a video game that you don't know?
Well, I mean, the goose genre of video gaming has always been underdeveloped. I've always said, I wish more people developed games that revolved around a goose. That would really be the golden goose in the industry that no one's chasing after.
Hey, I like that. But yeah, basically what you do is you're a goose and you're in this like cute little idyllic town and all you're supposed to do is like cause mischief.
Oh, so it's just Goat Simulator.
Kind of Goat Simulator, okay. But you're just a bad-tempered goose.
Bad Goose.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, it's a sequel to Bad Santa 2. Bad Goose.
Bad Goose.
Bad Goose.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So.
Interesting.
Yeah. But I would really like to try that. Roast a Chinese style. Mm. Yeah. Mm.
How do I get invited to your roast goose?
You might be. Okay. You might be. Okay. I'm sorry. You're not a dead set invite.
That's all right. I'll do more podcasts with you. I'll pay off my contract, and then we'll see if we become friends after that.
You did just insult me with my mother I cooked you
before
Japanese
karage. Started recording, I teamed up with Cleon's mom to. We both dissed him a bit, but.
After I fed him my freshly cooked karage.
I blamed his poor handwriting on the years of anime he squandered watching.
It's just that I secretly wanted to write in kanji. So my writing was more like
my
kanji.
My handwriting's messy enough for it to look like kanji and the Japanese will be able to read it. Lupin the third, Lupin the third, Lupin, 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 Lupin the third, Lupin, 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 Lupin the third. There's a point there.
Alright, welcome ladies and gentlemen. My name is Cleon.
I'm Ben.
And we are Asinine Lupin.
A very sexy podcast where we talk about anime.
We are a sex nine.
A sex nine.
A69 Lupin.
We are a podcast that talks exclusively about Lupin the Third. Which is a Japanese anime about a master thief known as Lupin.
Yes, and he is the third one.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. So today we're going to be talking about the second story arc in Lupin the Third Part 5, which aired in 2018. I highly doubt this will be like the first episode for many people. I feel like they'd probably start off with that pilot or an episode which covers the first story arc, right? So we probably don't need to go too much into
the characters.
Yeah, so would you like to just summarize the story from the arc a little bit and then we can get into what our thoughts?
So the first arc, very... technology focused and heavy. We looked at Lupin combating the modern world problems. This arc is very interesting in the fact that it suddenly turns around, does a 180, and we focus in on Lupin in a very rural area of France in a kind of a flashback that feels very vintage, a quiet little bar in the hillside somewhere. He's talking to an old man, which is a bit peculiar because Lupin, he has many contacts, but he seems quite affectionate for this old man. And I'm going to forget all the details, but this old man...
Gaston?
Gaston, he calls him, yeah. No one is quite as large as Gaston. no one eats as many eggs as Gaston. But he hands Lupin a book and says... Oh, no, I've forgotten everything. But...
basically, there's this book that has some very important information in relation to... French politics and security.
Yeah. I think he clues in Lupin on how to steal a painting that he needs because there's some information behind this painting, and he tells him to read this book when he dies, say a prayer from this book, he says. So, yeah. You know, at first you think maybe it's a Bible or something, you don't really know. Lupin and Jigen go on a classic heist. They break into a fancy museum, into this very secure vault that's owned by Mr. B, where the B stands for black hole, because this vault is filled with some of the best treasures in the whole world. Any other kind of criminal other than Lupin will be fully at home with taking one relic from, like,
yeah.
There's all this priceless art, stuff left over, I don't know, from, like, Atlantis. There's, like, the original Beatles album that had the picture of them naked on the front. There's all this priceless stuff that no one's touched for years.
And it's actually based on stuff that happens in real life. Some very famous paintings from painters that we know, like Salvador Dali. One of his most famous paintings, The Elephants, will never be seen by most human eyes because it's actually in a private collection.
That's
not
out
for the public. It's not in any museum or exhibition. And I know this because Salvador Dali is my favorite painter, and The Elephants is my favorite painting.
Oh, wow. So you've seen it?
I've seen it online.
Right.
And I've seen pictures of it.
Only a few people have seen it in real life.
Yeah. I did get to see The Persistence of Memory by Salvador Dali, which is the Melting Clocks one, at the NGV last year, which was amazing. I stared at it for like 30 minutes.
Yeah, okay.
It's gorgeous.
I hear he also lost some because he had a few and he left them out to dry on a hot day and they just melted.
Really?
No.
That sounds like something that would happen.
He was going with the melted clocks. His paintings just melted and then just fell down the drain and no one could retrieve them.
You could have gone for a joke where, like, he felt like his time melted away. He needed a workshop that. Yeah, it wasn't obvious enough. Like, I guess I am pretty dense, but you could have workshopped it a little bit more. Yeah, anyway, so, so then there's this art collection where there's this really, you know, hard-to-find stuff going on.
Yeah, and Lupin finds a Picasso that no one's ever witnessed, and that alone is super valuable.
Yes.
He meets some, like, art collector guy in a secret basement, so it's, I guess, it's not so important what happens in this arc. What's important is the theming of, we've moved on from the technology a little bit, everything's... Oh, there's a lot of wooden textures and interiors. It doesn't feel modern. They're playing off a lot of, like, 60s spy tropes again, or, like, the action movies of that era of, you know, like, there are guys who are also after this painting, and they're all in trench coats and the hats being very inconspicuous. No one dresses like that in the modern day and age. That's, like, last time people did that was, like, in the 80s New York. Like, everyone's very spy focused. All the shots are often at nighttime or in sunset, so you feel, like, kind of the twilight of this era, and yeah, they're dealing with physical drops and trading and stuff. Anyway, Lupin and Jigen are soon tailed by FBI agents, and they realize this. Or I don't know if they're FBI agents, but they're men in black suits, and they realize this, and they decide to bolt and sprint, and they just use a very simple classic maneuver of running in two separate directions, so the guys have to chase them. And this scene is cool because it's very, like, old world action. Like, there's not a whole lot of props or gimmicks used in this sequence. It's just them running, and it's a very small scale threat. They could easily overpower these guys, but they're just doing the old school, old spy, old world thief montage of action.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, what this arc evokes a lot is, the old methods of thieving, which then hits a really... Also, do you want to say
this? I was just going to say, like, apart from the art element, it's basically an espionage thriller.
Yeah, it's very much that. It's very grounded spy thing. Even I think the humor is dialed back for this arc compared to some of the other ones.
Agreed. And, you know, the fact that it then links into politics, because the information that it has is all of the corrupt things that the government and the police have done. So it's this black book of secrets.
Yeah, we start to find out that the political secrets in this... Oh, so they uncover that the bad guys get their hand on their book, which was in a very interesting scene because Lupin goes to drop off the book and they attack and invade him. And Lupin, to get out of the situation, uses a smartphone that is programmed to his voice to emit a flash. So the series is not letting us forget that modern technology exists. That's still a big important part of this whole series, a season. But the rest of the scene is very old world, and so he escapes it that way. They get their hands on the painting, they cut open the painting and find the actual book inside, this little black book that has all these political secrets that could be used. I think the book contains all the police's corruption,
yes,
or in all of France,
yeah,
and all the secrets there could sway a politician to become easily in control of. I don't know what they have. Probably not presidency.
Prime Minister, maybe?
Something like that. Yeah. They would get in control of the country because they could just blackmail the heck out of everyone. So this becomes a hot topic for a particular corrupt politician that wants to make his way up the ranks. So much so that he hires assassins to capture Lupin and stuff. But Lupin is able to seal back the book very easily. You know, these guys weren't that much of a threat at this point. And he hands it in to Gaston in his homestead, and he wanders over to the grave. Oh, no, sorry, I skipped ahead. He hands it over to Gaston, and then he finds out that Gaston actually died a month ago.
Yes.
And he's like, wait, what? But I gave him the book already. That's when we learn that someone has been impersonating Gaston. Lupin goes to his grave, sees that he's dead, reads the book that was handed him for the prayer, and finds out when he like slides the paper upwards, he reads a name, Albert. And Lupin has a weird reaction. He's like, Albert. And Jigon's like, who the heck is Albert? Like,
yeah.
And that's kind of what this story kind of unpacks, though I don't think this arc answers all the questions in,
yes,
who is Albert in relation to Lupin?
Yes, so Albert is a French politician, basically. Well, not really a politician, he's kind of like part of the Secret Service. He's kind of the guy that politicians and police go to get information.
He's pulling strings in the shadows, yeah, and he seems to have his eyes set on France in, or controlling France in some way.
Yeah, and so he is aiming to... He's we see him in part one in places here and there, kind of monitoring what Lupin is doing. So he's not a new face entirely, but he basically is after the Black Book to control France. We don't really know, again, whether it's for nefarious or virtuous means, but he definitely has some very grand schemes in place.
And what's striking about Albert's appearance when we do see him is he's got a design that is very similar to Lupin's. It's a specific set of proportions that they usually reserve for the main characters in the show.
Yeah.
It's something to do with... like he basically looks like Lupin's head shape, but in, yes, like a blonde mop.
Their
wig
face,
with glasses.
Yeah, their face and head shape are exactly the same, but then what's different is, you know, their eye colour, their hair, things
he,
like that.
Albert wears a bit more formal attire, a bit more low-key, and... we start to see some of Albert and his personality, and he seems kind of the opposite of Lupin. He's not flamboyant, he keeps his cool, he has a different sexuality to,
yes,
Lupin, and he's not like over the top with that either. It's,
yeah,
very subdued and subtle.
Yeah.
And they seem to have some kind of like polar opposite dynamic going on. This comes to a head as Lupin starts to chase after him for this book, that they are connected in the past via flashbacks. They seem to have both been involved in thieving missions in the past and have a relationship formed through there, and some bad blood happened and went down. And this comes to a head when Lupin confronts him on a bridge in France. It's a famous bridge.
Oh, really?
Yeah, France has a few bridges in a row that are like this bridge, but this bridge is a very famous one. I've driven over in Midtown Madness on the original Xbox.
You've been... Oh,
no.
I was going to be like, when did you go to Europe? Because I know you've been to North America.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
No, and it's also a major scene in the Metal Gear Solid franchise takes place on that bridge. So
classic.
Which is about, like, Solid Snake confronting kind of his... brother and clone, so it's interesting that Lupin kind of tapped into the same things as some betrayal and double crossing that goes down here, and the same things happens. Like Albert has bad blood for Lupin, Lupin has bad blood for him, and Albert shoots him in, I can't remember, the head or the chest. He shoots him somewhere,
yeah.
And Lupin dies again for the second time this season, which is shocking. But he's left there very bleeding, and this time Lupin doesn't really have a trick.
His trick is that he has his friends.
Yeah, his friends come and they rescue him. I guess, yeah, that's a good point. His friends come and rescue him. They go to the sewer and help him recover. But he does just bite the bullet, and I think he is slightly caught off guard.
Yes.
That he's shot. I think he expected more from Albert at this point. Lupin recovers, and the politician ends up in control of the book, backstabbing Albert. And the politician sends out some assassins to go after Lupin and Albert, and the assassins are interesting, but also not interesting. Interesting in the sense that, like, their design is pretty good for all of them.
There's one, like, super goth S&M person.
Yeah, very bizarre. She's got piercings, like, talons that are coming out of her elbow. She's got, like, a metal nail. So she's just, like, if you punched her, you would stab yourself at any point.
Yeah, and she's, like, an ultra sadist, I
guess. Yeah. And very modern design for how kind of old world it's felt. There's a tiny Japanese girl with, like, what are they called? Kunai?
Yeah.
Kind of things that's tied to metal wire. And she can, like, use it as a grappling hook.
Oh,
and
my gosh.
She's got an eye patch. There's a lot going on in her character design that implies history, but nothing is ever unpacked for these characters. And then the most interesting is you've got this guy that he kind of reminds you of, I don't know, have you seen, like, that Vampire Hunter D anime? He's got, like, a big hat and a scarf and long hair. He fights vampires. But then he's got, like, the face mask of that jester guy from Super Paper Mario.
Yeah.
He's very cartoony and, like, a clown. And he has these they're the coolest weapons.
Yeah.
Like, batons that are also guns. So you just smash him in the head, shoots the gun. He's quite a threat to Lupin and his friends. And they're quite colorful, and you think they're going to unpack into a deeper story. They don't really.
No, they get defeated, and the guy with the mask that Ben was talking about before, we don't even find out who he is, and he's kind of...
No, yeah, that was bizarre.
Yeah, they build him up a fair bit, like he kills an ally of Lupin's. They fight him probably about 3 or 4 times before they get rid of him, and it's just interesting that he never ends up being anything else. Mm.
I wonder if they're set up as like a meeting of, like, Japanese kind of flamboyance, and also, like, the James Bond style of the bad guys have a team of interesting villains, but they're just there to be disposed of in a fight scene, like the Objobs and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I wonder if that's kind of the tone, why they chose them, or if they just enjoy designing weird villains for Lupin to fight. I'm not 100% sure. We start to learn more about Lupin and Albert. They end up, they're forced into a team-up to get this book back. They have to fight all these assassins together. But we learn, and this is where I think why this arc is important, because it does feel a bit out of place and a bit weird, and it will become relevant later, in a later part of this season. But what we learn about Albert is that he was kind of trained in some capacity as a thief alongside Lupin, and they were partners the same way Lupin and Jigon were partners to an extent. You're not 100% sold on that idea.
No, I don't think they were partners. I think they were like almost apprentices in a certain way. Though, again, I just don't know how to feel about there being someone who taught them.
Yeah.
I have, my idea is, and it parallels the Sherlock Holmes, Mycroft Holmes sort of thing, that both of these guys, I think they actually are blood brothers in the sense that they are related. They might not be full brothers. They might have one parent that's different. Maybe they have, like, different mothers or something. But I think that they are just both gifted children who, you know, were just too smart to fit into modern society, and they kind of worked through it in different ways. Like, Lupin rebelled.
Mm.
Albert initially rebelled, but eventually kind of figured out that, no, I can actually use this to make some change. Because I think, you know, he definitely wants to progress France. And I guess, why France? Unless that they're linked to Arsène Lupin.
Yeah.
You know, and Arsène Lupin had such a deep connection to France as well.
Yeah.
So that kind of gets me thinking, you know, could they be actual brothers, and is that why they kind of implied that Lupin the Third is a title? Because maybe they are both Lupin.
Yeah,
you know.
Well, the impression. What's interesting about this flashback is it's a flashback that doesn't tell you all the answers. Usually, flashbacks are just massive exposition dumps. This just cuts to the information that those characters are remembering. It's not designed really as a mechanism for the audience to learn.
No.
And so they even cut to random adventures they have, such as we see a scene where they fight
a minotaur.
No, not a minotaur. It's like a leopard Mayan warrior, and he is like that guy from Tekken, like the leopard-headed guy from Tekken.
Yes.
And they're just fighting that, and it's just bizarre. And they have banter about that, and I'm like, what adventure is this? This looks amazing.
Yeah.
But you see. The impression you get from the flashbacks is there's a lot more history here going on with Lupin than has ever been explained in the series. He's quite young. He's wearing, like, one of those American baseball, like, Letterman jackets that usually implies that someone is quite young in this scenario.
Yeah. How old do you reckon he is then? I reckon, like...
I mean, he looks, like, mid-20s, at least.
I reckon younger, bro. I reckon, like, I think he is 18 meant to be 21, younger. I reckon, because he... Yeah.
But the implication here is that Lupin has spent a significant amount of time growing up in France, in Paris, with... oh my gosh, I've just blanked his name. With Albert. And they have... Their formative years of thieving occurred here. And that's information we've never really occurred. And is interesting because this season was supposed to tie Lupin to the original French novel in which he's based and he's the grandson of. But... Yeah, we don't ever see that connection as an audience. It's just all this implied stuff. So you have to work it out and piece it together yourself. So we don't truly know their relationship or what's going on. But I think what is set up here that's really important is Lupin and Albert. And this is why I think the partner theory a bit stronger than you.
Okay.
This is what I clicked just rewatching it now. Yeah. Lupin and Albert were a team. At least in Lupin's perspective.
Okay.
And to Lupin, this is his first time he kind of clicked that, like, he's starting to love the game of thieving.
Yes.
He's realizing this is my identity now, this is what I'm good at, and there's other people in the world that do this and enjoy this as much as I do, and he thinks Albert is that person. And Albert decides, hang on, I could actually use my talents to get control of France, to get more power, to influence this world. Thieving is really a small-time gig with no purpose and no end. And Albert kind of grows and matures beyond the game of thieving and wants to grow in that. You look very excited.
I do, because you know what line really stood out to me when we were re-watching it? Where he was like, ooh, something's happening. It's exciting to move these pieces. Albert's talking about, like, the political things.
Yes.
So rather than the small-time thing of just stealing something... Yeah. His excitement is now coming from controlling the political threats. He's grown
bored of thieving. And I think this is really interesting. And this is a very subtle character development for Lupin that is expanded by the end of this season.
Yeah.
But I think Lupin feels very betrayed that Albert feels like this. To Lupin, thieving is the best thing in the world. It's the life he's never going to live. But I think he's very aware of his own growing power level at this point as a thief. Lupin has the skills to achieve and do anything he wants. If Lupin wanted to go rogue and take control of a country, he could easily, without a doubt, pull that off. But he never will, because thieving is the most important thing to him.
Yeah.
So for someone to say, I'm going to leave you, I'm not going to do this life with you anymore, Lupin, one, feels very alone and isolated, but two, he can't understand that viewpoint. At all. That's a complete nonsense. Mm. Why would you give this? This is the best life. This is the best thrill you can get in life. And so I think the partners thing helps, consolidates that Lupin feels incredibly betrayed by Albert, and that's the start of their bad blood. And I imagine they butted heads maybe a few times after that and then never again interacted because they just walked in different directions. And this is illustrated in the scene beautifully by the road where Albert shoots him is the same road where they walked in two different directions across the bridge. It's like a linear crossroads that they kind of walk on.
Yeah. I found it really interesting because, you know, Lupin, thinking back to A Woman Called Fujiko Mine, we have a Lupin who's bored by thieving by himself. So, you know, right now, in that flashback, he's in that phase where thieving is everything, you know, then gets betrayed by Albert, then he goes on his own solo thieving escapades for several years until he gets bored, and then that's when Fujiko, Jigen, Goemon start to get introduced. So I think that's a really interesting thing of like to kind of timestamp where he is in his relation to thieving, and now it's less about just him thieving, it's more about he and his friends kind of having adventures and stuff
together. Well, it affects his relationships with his friends because at this point, as we discussed in the last episode, him and Fujiko are at odds with each other. And there's questions of like, well, is one of them going to walk away from the game? If Fujiko is over her relationship with Lupin, is she also getting over her relationship with thieving and is she moving on? In which case, Lupin would feel incredibly betrayed.
Yeah.
With the nature of his friends, it's his friends that rescue him, and the only real reason Lupin can succeed whilst he's very talented himself is his friends are always there to back him up. However, as this arc continues, we do get a fight scene between the pierced girl and Goemon. And the fight feels forced a little bit. Goemon usually is very involved in Lupin's adventures when he comes in as backup and he understands the threat. Goemon felt like this was a hassle, this fight. Usually he understands the duty. This time he felt he was just going through the rhythm. And even the pierced lady says all these lines and stuff. They don't really seem relevant to Goemon, she's just saying generic, like, threatening BDSM throwaway lines. And I don't think Goemon connects to fighting her as a rival, though he sees the challenge, but is able to easily overcome her and slices her in half. And it's really gory. Like, it's nearly out of place gory scene.
It plays on that age-old samurai trope of, I cut something pointless again.
Yes.
You know?
And he does that, and you see him sigh. And so then we start to wonder, well, maybe Goemon's considering walking away from this lifelessly. And that becomes a way stronger theme further down the line.
Yeah.
So it goes to show that Lupin's enjoyment of thieving is there and present, but he needs people that also help perpetuate him in that lifestyle. And I don't think Lupin would be Lupin unless he had his friends along for the adventure as well. And I think Lupin's starting to ask that question about himself of, like, how important are my friends? Because when he's with Albert, during the team up, they start to love... He starts to like the game a little bit as well. He plays Lupin as bait to help him get past guards or Lupin. He's like, all right, we'll run on the count of three. And on three, Lupin runs out and he waits to shoot the guys at the top. And he's having fun playing around. And they work together to kill the assassins. And he's enjoying the game.
But at the end of the day, all he's after is that information because he has that long-term plan. Lupin has no long-term plan.
No.
That's the kind of difference between the two. Albert is building up to something. Lupin is just having fun in the moment, right? And so you have the ending where Albert tries to take the book and keep it for himself. And he thinks he's won, but then he walks away and he has a look and Lupin has the real book.
Well, they meet back at the crossroads and Lupin is trying to reminisce, and it's nearly like Lupin for a moment believed that Albert would rejoin the team and follow him on adventures, and Albert very decisively steps out, but he has backstabbed Lupin, but Lupin has backstabbed
double
Albert
crossed.
And he realizes the book is a decoy and it's got Lupin's the third's name, proving that Lupin is the one that inherited the title, even though Albert very easily could have as well.
Yes, and I also like that idea that the person who doesn't actually want to use the information is the one that got it.
Yes.
You know, like Lupin kind of saying, hey, I know you have these plans and everything, but at the end of the day, it's the thrill that wins, you know, which I thought was really, really interesting. And Albert, at that point, it's endeared him. I think he understands a little bit of why Lupin does the things that he does, but he also acknowledges that now he's doing something else. Mm. His goal doesn't change. He still wants to control France and elevate it to becoming the center of the world. But, you know, he kind of respects Lupin, whilst I think in that flashback, he kind of looked down on him. Yeah, so this is kind of like more a story. If you're looking at the lens of how their dynamic works, it's more about Lupin earning Albert's respect for his way of life.
And I think, like, Albert's... Well, this arc is probably not my favorite part of the whole season. It's a little bit too tame and subdued, and
it's a little bit too insular. I mean I really did like that we got a preview of what Lupin was like pre-jacket. And it's the only time in any Lupin media that I've consumed where he's not jacketed. It's kind of pre, like, and I like how they use that as a visual device. It's before he became Lupin the Third. You know, so
he's not wearing a business suit.
Exactly. He hasn't become Lupin the Third yet. And I think I really like that idea. I just think though, we probably needed a little bit more of an answer to that.
It would have been more satisfying. And it's bizarre because Albert pays off a little bit more further down the track, but it's not enough where I felt like that character was fully utilized. And I don't know what they're planning in the future. It seems like they may have ended the series for the moment, but I wonder if Albert will come back one day and play an important role, because he is a really good rival for Lupin.
He's a foil for Lupin.
He's not what you expect in a rival. I think you expect a Zenigata character that's a flamboyant, similar to Lupin, can keep up with his antics. But Albert is very controlled and subdued. He's as cool as a cucumber, and yet when he's out on the thieving thing, he really shows a dislike for the game. He secretly enjoys it, but he expresses a dislike for the game in that it's boring to him, it's not achieving his goals, and he really acts like he's moved on. It's like when you have a good friend in primary school and, you know, used to hang out and like the same TV shows and video games,
yeah,
and then you go to different high schools and you hang out with them and they're into very different interests and stuff now, and it's hard to relate. You want that old yeah. friend and talk about that old stuff.
Hey man, what anime are you watching? Oh, I don't do anime anymore. Yeah. I have a girlfriend now.
I do sports now.
Like, I do sports
now. Oh, okay. Have you watched the sport anime about a card game from Japan?
Hey, plug, Chihaya Furu is really good. But yeah, I think it was really interesting to have Albert as a character. And it was good to have someone... I mean, even though Lupin technically won at the end... He only really won because he had his friends,
and
which
Albert
is cheesy
describes
to say.
It as he won the battle.
Yeah,
this, or he won this round. Yeah,
yeah. But if it was just a one-on-one, I actually think Albert surpasses Lupin.
Well, they displayed that he shot Lupin, and Lupin didn't really have a backup plan.
No.
He's just lucky his friends were there to care for him.
Mm. And which is a really interesting parallel to Sherlock Holmes, which in our pilot episode we kind of talk about how a lot of Arsène Lupin comes from a mirroring Sherlock
yes.
Holmes, and in that, you know, Sherlock and his brother Mycroft is the smarter one, but he works in the government because he knows that he can use his intelligence for bigger things.
Yeah.
And this is all about going kind of back to the end of the first story arc where Ami asks Lupin, why do you do the things that you do? And he's like, I wouldn't be Lupin if I didn't do
yeah.
that. This is Lupin saying the same thing to Albert, you know, I'm doing this because I'm Lupin.
Yeah.
I know that you have your grand
it's
plans.
It's who I am. I became this and I can't be
yeah.
anything else.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So
and I thought you were going to be this,
yeah.
but you didn't want to. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think looking at it as that meta-analysis of, well, what is Lupin the Third? This story, I think at the end of the day, looks at what could Lupin the Third be? You know, if he wasn't a thief, he could probably rule the world
yeah.
from behind the scenes. He would never be like the king or
no.
prime minister.
I think there's an element of Lupin that is him and his personality would
yeah.
never quite allow for that.
Yeah.
But his skill set definitely does.
Yeah. He could be the person that controls everything behind the scenes, you know, pulling all the strings
yeah.
and everything, because he has such a strong social intelligence. He is very creative. He's very adaptive.
We see a scene in this where he dresses up as Fujiko,
oh.
and he can imitate Fujiko's voice perfectly
oh,
and
yeah.
arouse men, and it's like, dude, that guy can do anything. You
yeah.
can pull off Fujiko. You can't get away with anything.
I wouldn't be surprised if in the eventual, maybe not eventual, but if we ever do see like how Lupin got the skills that he did, where, you know, he trained with people in the KGB and stuff like that, because a lot of the skills and stuff that he shows isn't just thieving skills. He has like espionage, like KGB level
yeah,
skills.
Yeah.
Which was shown in this story arc, which is probably the closest to the espionage genre.
I like to know like his combat aspect, like how much of it is his natural skill, how much is random accidents, and how much is actual training.
We do know a little bit of an answer to that.
Do we? I don't remember.
Think about the end of the series and Goemon.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
yeah
so
yeah.
we do know about his prowess. I think a lot of it, when we do see him be goofy, is him kind of just sticking to his aesthetic, but
yeah.
we know that.
Well, his fight is a bit like the drunken masters.
Yeah,
like, it's
I
all
like that.
Destruction
yeah.
and fake out of being
yeah.
a klutz, and
yeah.
he's actually in control of the fight the whole time.
He is. But you know, it's really interesting how we have this character who's so like a god level skilled, but is still so interesting, relatable,
yes.
and still works out in the plots.
Yeah,
you know,
that's what amazes me is in the Western storytelling notion, we always think that characters need to have mega flaws
yeah.
and that if they have to be on our level of relatability, otherwise we can't relate
yeah.
to them. But Lupin is someone that is can achieve whatever he wants to achieve, and usually we view that as that's the end of story writing. You can't
yeah.
write someone that has done everything they need
yeah.
to do. Lupin, they find new ways to make that creative.
Yeah,
that's what's so enjoyable.
Yeah, and you know that no matter what, he's always going to make it out of that situation.
Yeah, it's
there's
it's
that formula
that you know he will, but you're there to view how he does it.
Yes.
There's genuine interest in the journey, not just the destination.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, this was an interesting story arc. I would agree. It probably wasn't my favorite from this part, but I do appreciate that we got it. My main kind of thing is that I hope we explore this further.
Yeah.
In a potential part 6.
I do hope Albert comes back into play.
Yeah. I just think we need to learn a little bit more, but it's hard because part of it is, does it really matter?
Yeah.
You know, but...
We don't want all the answers. No. All the mysteries of Lupin answered.
Yeah, you know what this reminds me of? This reminds me of the whole Wolverine thing. You know, he kind of ceased to be as interesting once we did his origin story and everything like that, you know?
Because I remember when I was getting into Wolverine, like, I learned, oh, he's actually older than World War II. He's been around since the 1800s. And at that point, that's probably the most interested I've ever been in Wolverine. It's like, oh, that's... What kind of lives did he lead before we saw him as the modern gruff Canadian we know him today? And then when I read the 1800 Wolverine Origins book, while some of it is interesting, a lot of it was pretty boring, comparatively. And I'm like, I guess, like, I thought I wanted that, but I didn't actually want those answers. I wanted to imagine Wolverine's life.
Do you know what Chris Claremont's actual ending for Wolverine is?
No.
It's awesome. So basically, like, his idea of how the Wolverine story ends is that he is the last living creature in the universe, and the other last living creature is the Phoenix Force and Jean, and they hook up at
the end of the universe.
So cool.
Yeah. Anyways. Sucks to be Cyclops, but that's cool.
He always does get the bad end of the stick. Anyways, back to Lupin. So... Yeah, I don't know if I would want entirely a Lupin origin story, but I think I would like some more information about where he got some of those skills.
We were discussing it would be a cool experiment if there was a season of Lupin that was set as, like, small stories in all the characters' origins, in that we tackled some of, like, teen Lupin learning some skills. Obviously, we don't get a long arc. We just get this episode. He's learning how to use grappling hooks or that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then we would also cut to some episodes would be about the other characters before they met. So, little stories about
similar to Cagliostro, the flashback in Cagliostro where he fails to steal it. You know, I would like to see him having failed in a couple of missions because we know that he's a god level now. But it would be interesting
There's
to
no
see...
way he could have always been this perfect.
Exactly, exactly.
And he's not like Batman. He doesn't have to be perfect for narrative reasons.
So. Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, that's our episode on the second story arc in part 5. Any other thoughts or threads there, Ben?
No, it's just important to make note that, that book comes really important later on. And the tension of, what is Lupin and... You know, Lupin loves this game, but does everyone else love this game? They're really important themes to carry over,
Yeah, it's a very existential season. Why is he doing the things he's doing? Who is he? And where to from here? I think the last question there we will answer at the end of
the
series.
I think so,
Okay, so, you can find us on Asinine Lupins. Please subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Pocket Casts. We're on a bunch of other platforms, but I just can't remember them yet. Social media-wise, we're on Twitter and Facebook, AsinineLupin for
Give
both.
Give us a like and a comment.
Yep, our email is asininelupin@gmail.com. Please email questions, thoughts, comments. Also, for potential listeners, if you exist by the time this episode comes out or any time in the future, let us know whether you like our current format, the fact that we're just doing it one story at a time rather than an episodic thing. It's just that because sometimes the episodes don't involve that much plot, so there's not as much to talk about. It's better to kind of talk about it in retrospect.
And I'd like to know if you've got any other interpretations of how you view Lupin's origin or what you think might be his deeper connection to Albert. We'd like to hear that too.
Yeah, what's your Lupin origin.
Yeah. It's like, you know, like season 6 of Community's ending is season 7 can be whatever you want it to be.
Yes.
I feel Lupin's origin can be whatever you want it to be. So if you've got you definitely think these are things that may have happened before the series ever began, we'd like to hear that.
Yeah, definitely. So yeah, please subscribe, review, rate us, and so do you want to get into recommendations?
So my recommendation lately, I gotta think of the things I've been doing. I played through. Oh, can I give an anti recommendation?
Yeah, I mean, we try not to be negative, but if it's something that's gonna save lives,
This will save lives. Okay, so I've been playing through the Spyro the Dragon trilogy.
Ah,
So that got remastered for the PS4 and. it's maybe not the most amazing game in the world, and a few of the missions that have carried over have not endured the test of time, but I think Spyro has always held this really beautiful simplicity in its game design of there's items that are easy to collect, that you can 100% all the collectibles very easily. They make a beautiful sound effect when you collect them, and it feels good collecting them. They stand out visually. The momentum in the game, you can run around, you can fly, you can kill things with two alternating buttons, but the enemies have enough variety that they're very refreshing. There's a bit of fun and humor there. It's just a feel-good, easy-to-play game.
What? This seems like a positive review.
Okay, so the trilogy, the Spyro trilogy has always been on point. So I was nearly finished the trilogy. There's a few, like, BS collectibles I still need to get that, like, are a bit glitchy and stuff. I was like, I wonder what the fourth and fifth Spyro games are like, because I never really played them on the PS1. I only really played Spyro 1, 2, and did you even know there was a fourth?
I did
and fifth?
Not know there was a fourth or fifth.
Yeah, so I was like, I know they're worse than the trilogy,
okay,
but given how simplistic Spyro's gameplay is, I doubt they could be worse.
Okay.
Too much worse than the game. Like, pretty good. They've just got to be like below good.
Yeah.
I downloaded one of the games, and it was like, okay, so
this is the most tormented I've ever seen you, and I've known you for like nearly half a decade now.
True. So the story goes, the original company that was making Spyro was Insomniac.
Yes.
Who recently made a Spider-Man game,
yeah,
and made a bajillion dollars.
Which I need to play.
You should. Props to them for doing good Peter Parker,
yeah,
in this year, in 2018, our year of Peter Parker.
Yeah, fun fact for our listeners, me and Ben found out about each other and became friends because of our mutual love for Spider-Man, basically.
That's how the web between us grew. But, so Insomniac left, they were working for Universal, they didn't really have working for Universal. Universal owned the rights to Spyro, but Sony had an investment, and there was bad blood between Sony and Universal, and this affected Crash Bandicoot 2. So they got a new team to come in and make Spyro, and to spite Sony, they're like, we're also going to release in the GameCube. Now, the new team and company they got to make Spyro were basically kids straight out of college. They got them on, and the kid's like, man, we're working on Spyro, we've hit the big time, this is going to be so much fun. And they start making Spyro. They start planning a Spyro 4 and a Spyro 5. Spyro 4, villains are going to return, two villains are going to return and team up, and it's going to be fun. Spyro 5 is going to be the wedding between two of the main characters, and it's going to be really epic, and that's the one we're excited for. 4 is just a bridge to get to 5, and they start, as college students, start planning two Spyro games. So I think you already start to tell where this is going to end up.
Wow.
And their dream game is the fifth one, right? So they're faffing around doing concept art for both games, and they're spending their resources and developing two games at the same time with one small team. And Universal comes and is like, so we have to ship the game in 6 months. And they're like, oh, but we're not done yet. Can we have more time? And they're like, no, you have to ship the... We're like a Hollywood movie studio. You have to ship the game in that time. And they're like... Oh, so they rushed out the assets. They cut large portions of the game to the point where, like, there are characters and cutscenes that appear at the start of the game that never appear again. a reoccurring villain that was like that, the nasty Nork, a bad guy from the first game, is mentioned at the start of the game because he was meant to be a team up villain later on. He's not in the game at all.
No.
And the physics is the clunkier, going from, I mean, I don't know how much they've tampered with the physics for the remasters. It's pretty smooth, and they've had to redesign a lot of the geometry of the levels because it's modern. But going from the physics of the trilogy remake to this one is the clunkiest thing.
Oh,
it's
no.
like Spyro is being programmed to be swimming through marmalade the entire time, and it's, oh man, it's so bad. You can tell instantly the level design is not as clear. Models have, they would have looked good for the time, but they've not aged like the timeless PS1 kind of simple visuals.
Can I ask, why is it that as time progresses, we get worse at making platformers?
Yeah, I think a lot of platformers was to do with, one, the passion that was put into it,
yeah,
and two, the limitations imposed on the system.
Yeah.
I think less is more when it comes to a platformer. And in the 64 era, you had to work with special kind of textures that were a lot more compressed, or to design levels kind of with that look, you had to have very specific aesthetics, which is why Rare was really good at the texturing, why Banjo-Kazooie and Banjo-Tooie look, and Donkey Kong look amazing and still hold up. But yeah, everyone else, I don't think, had quite the same level design. I think platforms comes a lot down to the camera controls and the jumping. And to be honest, I don't think people put that much thought into those two things. I know when I was studying game design, we looked at doing jumping, and like they taught us you'd put this code in to do jumping, and it was terrible. I'm like, I don't think this is what it should feel like. It needs to be more intentional, and that has to feel good because that's your major component in the game. And so yeah, I think it's a lot to do with that. There's a lack of creative passion, and I think a platform is way harder than people think it's going to be. Mm. And that was the genre that all movie studios latched onto and pumped out, because I think it's relatively easy to make a bad one. You just have to have a small world filled with things you collect. You don't even need to have change up of gameplay between that. But that's where we went wrong, because then there was all these trash platformers, and then no one was interested in playing.
The last good one, apart from like every second, like those Mario ones on the Nintendo consoles, which were really good, like Odyssey was great. But apart from that, the last one that I was really into were the PS2 Ratchet and Clank games, which I really enjoyed personally. But prior to that, you know, I was a huge Crash Bandicoot, Spyro fan. I think it comes down to momentum
in your game world. It has to be fun to move, because that's the primary thing you do in the game. So my first recommendation is don't play Spyro Into the Dragonfly. One, the name is such a dumb dated reference to Into the Dragon, because you're collecting dragonflies in the game. But that's such a dumb dated reference, but it's not worth it in any capacity. Don't play it. That's my first recommendation. My second recommendation, if you want to play a good platformer, there's an indie game called Hat in Time that came out a couple of years ago.
What is it called again?
Hat in Time.
Okay, I'm going to send this to myself.
It's inspired by Wind Waker, kind of cel-shaded cutesy graphics. You play as a cute little like 12-year-old girl in a top hat that is collecting hourglasses.
And Hat in Time.
Hat in Time. And from a planet called Mafia Town. It's just... it's not even, like, a coherent game, really, if you stop and tear it apart, like, in terms of theming and collectibles. It's just passion has gone into this game, and they've made the momentum and mechanics really tight. So, when you jump, you can double jump, and then you can dive and, like, shoot forward diagonally, but then you can cancel out of that and do another jump. So if you fall off part of the level, you can kind of combo and survive longer distances than other games.
Kind of like when you use Yoshi in the Mario
games. Yeah, so that's what like Mario and Nintendo have always figured out, is Mario has a lot of jumps for kind of recovery or distance and stuff, and Hat in Time does the same thing, even tighter than I think Mario at times. Odyssey has, you know, the hat you can throw and combo off, and I think that is slightly better. But before that, Hat in Time was really giving Mario a run for its money with its momentum. And you can run through the whole levels and keep that momentum as you platform and maintain it. And it nearly does a better job being Sonic than Sonic the Hedgehog platformers do. And the level designs is always designed, like, if you fall off from a height, you can easily just go up another way to bounce your way kind of back up. So, and it mixes up with one level that's like a monster in a mansion. You have to stealth through it, kind of.
What console is it on?
It's being ported to a bunch of stuff now. So I believe it's on PS4, and there's a Switch version coming, and PC and stuff. So I recommend that. It's got a co-op mode as well. You can play the whole game with a friend. And
I might wait until it comes out on the Switch, because I love the idea of portable platformers. So that sounds really good. My recommendation for a bit of a change from Ben's is a TV show. It's actually... So, I know that this podcast is predicated on the fact that Lupin the Third Part 5 was our favourite show of last year. But if a new season of this show that I will mention aired last year, I would not be able to say that Lupin was my favourite.
Because I thought it was a ballsy claim that you made Lupin.
Yeah. In previous years... prior to 2018, every season that aired in a year, that show was my favorite. And it's Catastrophe, which is written and starred by... that's a clunky talking there. By Sharon Horgan and Rob Delaney. Rob Delaney, you'll know, was the normal human being guy in Deadpool 2. He was part of the group.
Peter?
Yes.
That's probably my favorite part of Deadpool 2.
Yeah.
I'm yet to see the PG edited version, which I feel may actually be an improvement than the R-rated version. Wait, do you know about this?
No.
Okay, can we sidetrack?
Yeah.
We will get to Catastrophe. Yeah, go. This is a bigger Catastrophe. Yeah, yeah. completely shamelessly, since Disney now owns the Deadpool contract, they've recut Deadpool 2 and released it in cinemas. Right now, you can go watch it again at cinemas.
What?
To be a PG-rated movie. The premise being, Deadpool breaks into Fred Savage's house, the kid that played the kid in The Princess Bride.
Yeah.
And he straps him to a bed, and Princess Bride style forces him to listen to his edited version of Deadpool 2, which is also retelling as a Christmas story.
Can I disappoint you?
Yeah.
I've never seen The Princess Bride.
Excuse me, ladies and gentlemen. While we we're just gonna pause this podcast here. I'm gonna go take Cleon out back and beat him with a copy of The Princess Bride. Then we're gonna sit down and watch The Princess Bride. And when we return, this podcast will be a Princess Bride podcast because this is the most shocking event that's happened in 2019 so far. This is, what the heck? Do you know how much you would love The Princess Bride? How have you not gone through life with people constantly referencing this movie?
They have, I just...
Do you know how much I have to pretend to love The Princess Bride to fit in with normal society? It's a good movie, but I don't think it needs people to say that one line all the time.
They say it all, they mention it all the time.
But it is, you'd love it. It's so good.
Yeah? Okay, I'll check it out. Is it on Netflix?
I'm not sure.
I'll check. I have access to all the streaming things, so I'll check.
If you ever see a still standing like video store, they'll still have a copy, I'm sure. It'll be their most rented thing.
Dude, did you know, like, I really wanted to watch that movie Shin Godzilla. We will get back to what we were talking about.
Just make one podcast about one thing? We should have made a podcast about all the things.
Anyways, I couldn't. There was no possible way of me watching Shin Godzilla unless I pirated it, and I just don't, like, right now...
Sorry, Japan.
Sorry.
Arigato.
So, this has a positive ending, because I just did not have... I don't have the energy, capacity, whatever, to pirate stuff anymore.
We're sorry.
Whatever! I've never pirated anything.
We're sorry to anyone listening to this that runs, like, a Godzilla-themed podcast.
Yeah, sorry. Sorry, Toho Yaro. That's a really good podcast, by the way. Anyway, so I found it in my local library.
No way!
And I rented it!
That's nuts!
And it was awesome, and it was a really great movie. I really enjoyed it. Back to my recommendation.
Yeah,
so, Catastrophe is probably the best comedy that's been made in the last 5 years. It's just the two main characters riffing off each other. So, the main thing is that it goes off the chemistry of these two characters. It's called Catastrophe because they have a one-night stand, the woman gets pregnant, and it's about them trying to make their relationship work.
And the baby is a cat.
Yeah,
and
basically.
That's the catastrophe.
It is the cat. And it's not only their cat, but it's their trophy too. Do you want me to take it there? Because trophy, whatever.
No, it's way worse than what I did. Bad. That's the true catastrophe in this situation. Anyway, sorry, I'll stop interrupting. Continue.
It's the funniest show on television, and also it has the best Carrie Fisher role ever. She's hilarious on it. Unfortunately, she can't be in the later season as she passed away between seasons 3 and 4. But her...
She's not coming back as a CGI model. Disney can do that. They have the technology.
Anywho, it's the best show on television. Watch it. For people in Australia, the first 3 seasons are on ABC iView. Unfortunately, season 4 hasn't been made available anywhere apart from in the UK. So... find that at your own pleasure. But yeah, highly recommend. Really good comedy. Yeah, so absolutely. Thank you. Yeah, so thanks everyone for listening. Ben, do you have any final remarks?
I just realized that instead of recommending Spyro the Dragon, I should have recommended The Orville. But I guess I'll save that for next time.
So I was recommended The Orville like day before yesterday.
I think I told
by
you
someone
earlier,
who...
but you didn't listen to me.
Yeah. I know you've recommended it to me for a while. No, you haven't. You've never mentioned it
I
to
have.
Me. No.
Yeah.
You mentioned Castlevania.
No.
And
Orville was like a year ago I recommended it to you.
Sorry. I was
That's
probably...
Okay. You heard it here first on the podcast.
I
recommended the Orville.
To be fair, a year ago, I was not ready to watch any new television.
That's fair.
But right now, I'm just binging a lot of new shows. Anywho, yeah, I was just recommended the Orville, like... Friday night by someone who has like virtually the same tastes as me. Not that I wouldn't take your recommendation,
it's
Benjamin, fine. But it has been consolidated.
It's not like it took
now.
Him a couple of months to watch Lupin after I recommended it. Here we are doing a Lupin podcast.
It did take another person's recommendation for me.
Never
to
trust
what
I say after that.
To be fair, you haven't given One Piece a fair go yet. You haven't.
Thanks for listening to our podcast, ladies and gentlemen.
Bye.
I'm Ben, this is Cleon. We'll catch you next time on our Lupin podcast.
Sayonara.
Which may or may not be a Princess Bride or One Piece podcast next time.